Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, Peter Beinart, began writing about Israel and Palestine 15 years ago because he feared the Jews of his generation were failing the Jews of his children's generation. Today, Peter Beinart is editor-at-large at Jewish Currents, a professor and media commentator. Peter Beinart dedicates his new book, Being Jewish After the Destruction of Gaza, A Reckoning, to the memory of his grandmother. He writes, "She disagreed with the arguments in this book, and her spirit is on every page." Well, here's what he writes on page 9. "This book is about the story Jews tell ourselves to block out the screams. It's about the story that enables our leaders, our families, and our friends to watch the destruction of the Gaza Strip, the flattening of universities, the people forced to make bread from hay, the children freezing to death under buildings turned to rubble by a state that speaks in our name and shrug if not applaud. It's about the story that convinces even Jews who are genuinely pained by Gaza's agony that there is no other way to keep us safe. My hope is that we will one day see Gaza's obliteration as a turning point in Jewish history." Peter Beinart is professor of journalism and political science at the Craig Newmark Graduate School of Journalism at CUNY, editor at large of Jewish Currents. He writes the Beinart Notebook newsletter and also conducts video interviews there. He's a contributor to the New York Times, an MSNBC analyst, and author of the new book, Being Jewish After the Destruction of Gaza, A Reckoning. Hi, Peter. Thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we just heard in the BBC headlines that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has instructed the military to immediately carry out, quote, powerful strikes on Gaza. And before we talk about that, Peter, I just wonder, how are you processing what has happened over the last 2 years? I mean, if you look at the numbers of what has happened in Gaza, it's just devastating to think that over 67,000 Palestinians have been killed, over 20,000 children, more than 10 children in Gaza losing one or both legs every day, according to the WHO, and then over 170,000 have been injured. And people say those numbers will rise as more bodies are found under the rubble. When you really sit back, how are you processing what has happened over the last 2 years?
I'm not really sure I am capable of processing it. I have this sense that we're in the immediate aftermath, maybe not even really the aftermath, in some ways it's ongoing, of an event of such magnitude that it's going to take decades and decades for people to try to come to terms with this. Again, this has been classified as a genocide by Human Rights Watch, by Israel's own leading human rights organization, B'Tselem, by the International Association of Genocide Scholars. And I think, I think if you think about the genocides that we witnessed over the last century, I think this what it means to process events like this is measured in generations, not in years. I still find myself completely overwhelmed by the horror of it. And just have this sense that it will be with me and with America, all with America, because we are so deeply complicit in this, and with the Jewish people for the rest of my life.
And you know what I think is so sad, and I wonder what you think of this. I mean, you have a chapter in your book called "To Whom Evil Is Done." You write about life in the Jewish communities near Gaza and how it was very difficult even before October 7th. And you write about how none of this started on October 7th. But some people say that if Israel had not responded in such a devastating way, that there would have been more attention on the people who lost their lives on October 7th. The Guardian had a really interesting video piece about how Israelis were responding to October 7th. They went to packed beaches and discos and things like that. And most of the Israelis they interviewed said, you know, there was so much of an outpouring of sadness after October 7th. And then 5 days later, everything changed. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think The problem, it seems to me, is that Israelis, Jewish Israelis in particular, on October 7th experienced an enormous, enormous trauma, and also a deep, a very, very profound humiliation, and a much greater sense of insecurity. We can think about the way the United States reacted to 9/11, but this was much more intense because the number of people killed was much, much greater as a proportion of the population because you had hundreds of people taken captive, which didn't happen. So in some ways, you kind of almost like from American perspective, imagine 9/11 plus the Iran hostage crisis, which was a huge issue in the United States in the late 1970s. But then also the fact that the enemy is on your border. It's not far away. And I think it's very, very easy for politicians under those circumstances to take those feelings of immense pain and suffering and anger and humiliation and deploy them to use massive, massive violence. And the tragedy for the United States and even more so, I think, for Israel, was that there wasn't a language that allowed people to understand the horror of what was done on October 7th within the context of oppression, that any effort to describe the reasons that for why October 7th happened was immediately condemned as justification. Again, similarly as in the United States, in a discussion, any discussion to try to understand why people in the Muslim world might have been hostile to the United States was equated with justifying these terrible acts that happened on October 7th, on 9/11. And so we weren't Israelis, I think, and for that matter, Americans, in talking about October 7th, didn't really have a conversation about the conditions of life for Palestinians on October 6th in Gaza, in the West Bank, and beyond, and were therefore not able to cultivate a conversation about political responses that might have dealt with the source of the problem. And unless you deal with the source of the problem, which is the brutal oppression of millions of people, their denial of fundamental human rights, you're not going to actually make people safer.
Let's talk a little bit about your family and how your views changed. You write that your maternal grandmother traced her ancestry to northeastern Spain, from which Jews were expelled in the 15th century. Her mom was born in Rhodes, a Mediterranean island that she was fortunate enough to leave before the Nazis deported the Jews to Auschwitz. Your grandmother was born in Egypt, but left as a child as anti-Semitism grew. You write, "She reminded me of these experiences when I expressed faith in America. She strongly advised me not to take Jewish safety for granted." Can you talk a bit about how you learned about these issues when you were younger?
Yeah, my grandmother was a huge influence on me, and the stories that she told me were perhaps not so different, I think, than the ones that many younger Jews are told by older generations, which is that because Jews didn't have a state of our own, a place where we ruled, our own national army, that Jewish life was fragile and dangerous, and that the creation of the State of Israel was the answer to that fragility, that insecurity. Even though my grandmother never moved to Israel herself, her brother did. He left Egypt and moved to Israel. And she would always say to me, "Listen, I don't know what's going to happen in South Africa. You don't know what's going to happen in America. Nobody knows, but Israel is a place that's safe for us." And so that narrative was just intuitive for me. I didn't really think of questioning it. It didn't mean that I supported everything that Israel had done. I didn't think Israel was perfect, but the basic idea of a state of, by, and for Jews for me was just self-evident, I would say, for all of my childhood and well into my adult life. It was a very, and I really honestly, if you had asked me 20 years ago or even 10 years ago whether I would question that view, I would have found it very, very difficult to imagine that I would. But there was a process for me of somewhat painful process that of rethinking that really came as a result of sustained interaction with Palestinians. As I began to have to face more and more what this state project had meant for Palestinians and the degree of violence that it inflicted on Palestinians, it changed my view, not just of the kind of moral costs of this project, but it changed my view of what I thought ultimately was the best path to Jewish safety.
And we'll talk about what changed your view exactly. I mean, you had personal experience talking to Palestinians about what they're dealing with. You write that you started really diving into Israel-Palestine publicly about 15 years ago because you feared the Jews of your generation were failing the Jews of your children, Ezra and Naomi. And you write that they're now teenagers and they've come of age in Jewish institutions where having you as a dad is not always easy. You write that since October 7th, it's become even harder. You've often winced as they describe navigating relationships made more difficult by your views, and not once have they complained. You write that you will be cursed on the street by people who believe Jewish loyalty requires your excommunication. You say that when you enter a synagogue, you no longer are sure who will extend their hand and who will look away. You and your wife have lost friends because of your views. And yet you're out there, Peter. I mean, you and I had to exchange many, many emails to book the show because, you know, you're doing so much writing. You're on MSNBC on a regular basis. So can you also talk about that?
Sure. I mean, I think, look, the first thing that's really important for me to say is that I live a life of like tremendous privilege compared to so many people around the world and so many people in the United States. I don't worry about my physical safety. I don't worry about whether I have a roof over my head and I have enough food to eat. So in a way, part of the reason that I feel obligated to say the things that I do and to do the writing and the work that I do is because of that unearned privilege I have. There's so many other people who, if they express views, could lose their jobs or even far worse than me, you know? And so what I do, you know, what I have to navigate is the fact that my views make some people unhappy, including sometimes people quite close to me. And that's difficult. It's painful sometimes, because the relationships are really precious to me. And I never have wanted to live my life outside the Jewish community. I've always wanted to live my life kind of right in the center of traditional religious communities where politics tends to be further to the right, because I find so much in traditional observant Judaism so precious to me. It's like the structuring force in my life. And I can't imagine living without that. But I'm grateful to have a sense of purpose in my work. I mean, I really, really feel like, I really just feel grateful that I have, that I can do work that's meaningful to me. And I also feel it's very meaningful to me to see that there are a lot of Jews, particularly younger Jews, who I think are going through their own process of rethinking and potentially reimagining what it means to live committed Jewish lives without the kind of moral corruption that that I think that's unconditional support for the State of Israel has brought.
And I bring that up because, as you know, and so many of our listeners know, this has really split up families. In some cases, people are no longer talking. Jewish people have lost jobs, and others, of course, for supporting Palestine. So that's one reason why I brought that up.
Yes, that's true. And you know, one of the things that one of the reasons that I wrote my book in the way that I did, really focusing it towards a Jewish audience, was not because I don't believe that people of all backgrounds have the right to engage in this conversation. Quite the contrary. I believe that if we're going to change U.S. policy and make America, put America on the side of freedom and human rights, it's really crucial that many, many more Americans come to be engaged in this conversation. But unfortunately, the organized American Jewish community often uses accusations of anti-Semitism to intimidate people from expressing their concern about Palestinian human rights and their criticism of Israel. And so in a kind of ironic way, I think if the conversation is going to become more open to people of all different backgrounds, then my community, the American Jewish community, has to change.
We're spending the hour with Peter Beinart. We're talking about his new book, Being Jewish After the Destruction of Gaza, A Reckoning. He says, my hope is that we will one day see Gaza's obliteration as a turning point in Jewish history. Peter Beinart is professor of journalism and political science at the Craig Newmark Graduate School of Journalism at CUNY, editor at large of Jewish Currents. He writes the Beinart Notebook newsletter and conducts interviews with a wide range of people. He's interviewed a number of Palestinians, a contributor to the New York Times and MSNBC analyst. If you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Peter, you write that what changed your perspective on Palestinian violence and led you away from the analogies with Nazis was encountering Israeli violence. You write that in your early 30s, when you first visited Palestinians in the West Bank, a woman told you that when she gave birth to a boy, one of her daughters started to cry. The woman said the Israeli army often entered homes in their village looking to arrest boys who threw stones. And if you had a son, it meant your home would likely be invaded, whether he had a stone or not. And that's when her daughter cried when her brother was born. You write that on a later trip, you walked through an entire village slated for demolition. To encourage residents to leave, the Israeli army had already disabled the local well. And the people you met, whose only crime was being Palestinian, in part of the West Bank where Israel doesn't want Palestinians to live, woke up every day wondering when the bulldozers would come. Can you tell us more about that and why you made that trip?
Sure. I mean, in some ways, it was a little bit accidental. I mean, the trip was partly to Israel, and I just thought I would have the opportunity to learn more about Israel, but to go back to a place that I have a very strong connection to, and I have friends. But we also went and spent a day in the West Bank, and it was that day in the West Bank that was just made me realize, first of all, how little I really knew about what Palestinian life under Israeli control was like. I mean, I think like some other Jews, I felt like I knew Israel pretty well because Israel had been a feature of my life since I was a child, but I really only kind of really knew what Israel meant for Jews and what Israel was like for Jews. I had never really experienced Zionism from what Edward Said called the standpoint of its victims. And I also, led my whole life as the citizen of a state in which the state was accountable to me. And so when I went to the West Bank, it's just always really important whenever we talk about a place like the West Bank to explain the structural legal realities there. The Palestinians in the West Bank live under Israeli control. The Israeli state has life and death power over them, but they can't become citizens of the state that controls them. They can't vote for the government that controls them. They don't live under the same legal system as their Jewish neighbors. Their Jewish settler neighbors have due process and citizenship and the right to vote. Palestinians have none of those things. They need military permission to travel. They live under a military law system where they can be held in indefinite detention. The prosecution rate is 99%. And I didn't really understand how terrifying such a state of affairs was until I actually started talking to people, because basically the state can do whatever it wants to you without really any accountability. And in any conflict between you and your Jewish neighbors, you lose because they have citizenship and you don't. It's a little bit like this segregated South. Imagine being how terrifying it is to be a black person in Mississippi in the first half of the 20th century. The state or your white neighbors have basically total power over you, and you have no recourse. And so it was those experiences of seeing that made me realize how brutal this was, and also made me realize how little I knew, and also made me realize something else that was the most painful of all, which is that when I started encountering Palestinians and talking to Palestinians and found that the people I met didn't want to kill Jews, and were just very much the same as any other group of people that one might meet, including the people in my own family, I'm ashamed to admit, somewhat surprised by that, because Encountering Palestinians made me realize that I had been carrying around a lot of dehumanization. That the problem was that when you grow up constantly talking about Palestinians, but not listening to Palestinians, it's a recipe for dehumanization. They become this kind of faceless, threatening mass of people rather than human, individual human beings. And that was something that I realized I had to confront, that the racism that I had grown up with in terms of the way that we talked about Palestinians.
Can you elaborate on that a bit? Because you have to wonder, how can the world allow something like this to happen in the year 2025, at a time when we have phones and we're watching so much of this in real time? I mean, so many of us have seen the devastation just minutes after it happened because of the Palestinian journalists in Gaza who have recorded all of this. And I think a lot about the whole concept of othering, and you know, how does the world allow this to happen other than because of what you just laid out there, that people are utterly dehumanized?
Yes, I think that's exactly the point. I mean, one of the things that's worth noticing is that we talk very frequently in the United States about anti-Semitism. When was the last time you heard someone accused of anti-Palestinian bigotry, right? Mm-hmm. It's a term that virtually doesn't even exist in the United States. And I think the reason the term doesn't exist is kind of like, what is it they say? The same thing that fish don't have a word for water, right? It's like, it's so omnipresent, right? The idea that Palestinians don't deserve to be treated equally with Israeli Jews is so standard. It's so normative. It's the view of most American politicians that we don't even think that might be a form of bigotry. And so I think that this assumption that Palestinians are lesser, that they don't deserve the same thing as Israeli Jews, it lays the foundation for basically excusing or justifying their starvation, their murder, saying that basically they brought it on themselves. And human beings, when they don't see people as truly equal, we have human beings a tremendous capacity to look away. I mean, think about how many Americans drive through this country and pass the names of towns, let's say, that clearly have Native American names, right? And don't think about what happened to the people who created those names, right? You don't think about it, right? We very rarely, most Americans, think about the fact that this country was created with the destruction of an entire continent's worth of peoples. And I think that human beings have that capacity unless we fight against it, unless we give people a voice, and we are forced to reckon with their humanity. Just the fact that you have social media alone isn't enough.
And Peter, we're all guilty of this, because I remember learning about this Palestinian photographer, Yahya Barzak, who's known for his newborn baby portraits. And these are just those very sweet photos we've all seen of the baby in a little basket surrounded by flowers and has a little umbrella over her head. And I found myself thinking, oh, wow, I didn't think that something like that would be available in Gaza. And I thought, well, why did I think that in the first place?
Yes.
Right. And so I think we all other and we all make assumptions. And one of the problems is that we hardly see Palestinians in the news. We hardly hear their voices. Mari Cohen, who writes for Jewish Currents, where your editor at large, had a piece a couple weeks ago, major news networks sideline Palestinian analysts. Leading Palestinian commentators describe canceled appearances and segments pulled from CBS and CNN shows. It's very rare to even see a Palestinian on our televisions.
Absolutely. And that, you know, this is what Edward Said, the great Palestinian literary critic, called the lack of permission to narrate. It's when you have a conversation about Palestinians, as is the norm in mainstream American media, First of all, you produce a kind of ignorance, because even if some of the people who you're interviewing might be, you know, smart people who've been, you know, who've been working on this subject, you're talking about a group of people without actually listening to them. And not surprisingly, I find that the people who tend to understand understand Palestinian politics best, understand groups like Hamas best, are Palestinians, right? And secondly, beyond that ignorance, you produce this dehumanization, right? Because you don't have people who you can look to and listen to and identify with and have to grapple with their perspectives. It's still, to me, astonishing how rare it is to see Palestinian perspectives. And I think in the mainstream media, and when you do allow Palestinians to speak for themselves, I find generally, again, not that all Palestinians agree, but that's precisely the point, right? Is to hear a range of different Palestinian perspectives. It often just completely reframes so many of the assumptions, so much of the language that tend to structure this conversation. And I think it's a tremendous, tremendous shame that that's still so rare.
Well, and then the Gaza plan that was released by the Trump administration with Jared Kushner, I mean, a Palestinian wasn't even, quote, allowed to be at that table. I don't think any Palestinian was involved in any of this.
Right. So this is a very, this is a very deeply colonial enterprise, right? Like, we know what's best for you, right? I mean, what group of people, any group of people in the world, would ever possibly trust their future to a group of people, who are making decisions while they're excluded from the room? But this is what we expect, the Palestinians to accept, right? Basically, whatever decisions Israel and America make on their behalf, or for that matter, the Egyptians or the Qataris or the Turks or whoever, we rarely think about the fact that Palestinians are not allowed to have their own, to have the process to choose their own leaders. The most popular Palestinian politicians are all in jail, right? Just as the most popular politicians in South Africa under apartheid were in jail. If you want to have a meaningful, serious conversation about the future for Israelis and Palestinians in this land, you have to allow Palestinians who have legitimacy within their own population to be at that table. And Israel and the United States systematically prevent that from happening.
We're going to take a quick break. Today, we're spending the hour with Peter Beinart. He's out with a new book, Being Jewish After the Destruction of Gaza, A Reckoning. He dedicates his book to the memory of his grandmother, writing, "She disagreed with the arguments in this book, and her spirit is on every page." Peter Beinart is professor of journalism and political science at the Craig Newmark Graduate School of Journalism at CUNY, editor-at-large of Jewish Currents. He writes the Beinart Notebook newsletter, contributor to the New York Times, and MSNBC analyst. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on our Authoritarian Playbook series tomorrow, AFT President Randi Weingarten will discuss her new book, Why Fascists Fear Teachers, Public Education and the Future of Democracy. Thursday, we'll talk about the government shutdown and what is next for SNAP and healthcare premiums. Today, we're spending the hour with Peter Beinart. We're talking about his new book, Being Jewish After the Destruction of Gaza, A Reckoning. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Before we get to emails, I want to make sure we have time to talk about this, Peter. And that is the cycle of violence and why you think this does not get more attention. You write, Israeli oppression is not the only cause of Palestinian violence. Palestinians, like all people, are responsible for their actions. But Israeli oppression makes Palestinian violence far more likely. Among academics, the point is not controversial. You write about a 2004 study of Palestinian suicide bombers during the Second Intifada. And the economist Bezalel Saleh found that almost half had suffered at the hands of the Israeli military. Either they'd been arrested or injured, or they had seen a family member injured, arrested, or killed. He concluded personal grievances have a considerable weight in motivating attacks. You also point to a paper in 2006 by two University of Toronto sociologists. They found most Palestinian suicide bombers gave up their lives to avenge the killing of a close relative. And this is why I would love to ask you why we don't talk about this more, because we throw around the word Hamas, but we don't really talk about who's Hamas, what is going on here, who are these Islamic Jihad leaders. You write, in November 1956, the Israeli military entered Gaza, then under Egyptian control, after Cairo blockaded the Straits of Tiran. In the town of Khan Yunis, according to Benny Morris, IDF troops shot dead hundreds of Palestinian refugees and local inhabitants in the town while searching for weapons. A 9-year-old boy named Abdel El Aziz Al Rantisi saw his uncle shot. He told an interviewer many years later, "I still remember the wailing and tears of my father over his brother. I could not sleep for many months after that. They planted hatred in our hearts." 3-year-old Ziad Al Nakla witnessed the execution of his father. 3 decades later, Al Rantisi helped found Hamas. Al Nakla now leads its smaller but equally militant rival Palestinian Islamic Jihad. Over the decades, this pattern has repeated itself over and over. Why aren't we talking more about this?
I mean, I think it goes back to this point about dehumanization. I mean, let's just imagine ourselves, right? Yes, there's always going to be some percentage of people in any society who might, you know, take up arms and try to kill people of another racial ethnic group just because they, because they have some kind of pathology or hatred. But the vast majority of people don't want to do that. They want to live their lives. They want to try to have a decent life for them and their families. People become more likely to take up arms when they are suffering the violence of oppression, and especially when they don't see a nonviolent path towards gaining their rights. So this is why you see generally in systems where there is oppression of one population, the oppressed population, some group of people in that population, some organizations will take up arms, right? In Northern Ireland, when Catholics were politically dominant by Protestants, the Irish Republican Army committed many, many, many violent armed attacks. They tried to assassinate the Queen. They tried to blow up Harrods department store in London. Nelson Mandela in South Africa was not a believer in nonviolence. He helped turn the African National Congress towards armed resistance. I mean, I want to be clear. Not every act of resistance is legitimate just because you are oppressed. Under international law, it is wrong to attack, to target civilians, period, no matter how brutal the oppression you face is. But the point that I'm trying to make is, if you want people to be safe, if you don't want there to be violent resistance, and especially not violent resistance that, God forbid, takes the lives of civilians, you have to deal with the underlying violence of oppression. And what you've had with Palestinians is a mass expulsion in 1948, another mass expulsion in 1967, and a system particularly since 1967, of what Israel's own human rights organizations call apartheid, in which millions of Palestinians live under Israeli control without basic human rights. That is a system of very brutal violence, which produces counterviolence. And the way of preventing that counterviolence is to give people a voice in government. When people have a voice in government, they are much less likely to turn to picking up arms, because they have a nonviolent mechanism for getting the government to listen to them. That's why after the Good Friday Accord in Northern Ireland, the IRA stopped blowing stuff up. It's why the Nkwanti Wesizwe, the military wing of the ANC, disbanded after apartheid ended in South Africa.
You also quote Gershon Baskin, an Israeli hostage negotiator who has spent countless hours with Hamas leaders, who says they recruit Hamas fighters from early ages from bereaved families immediately after each round of conflict. And you tell a devastating story about Mohammed Shahada and his best friend Ali, whom he calls the most thoughtful, most intelligent, most cultured, sophisticated person I know. The two young men debated everything from Ukraine to Jimmy Fallon. Ali held strong opinions about Hamas. He resented them with every bone in his body. He was appalled by what happened on October 7th. But then the Israeli assault forced Ali's family to relocate three times within Gaza City. He said he had to walk through miles of rubble-filled streets to flee from one bombed neighborhood to another while hearing screams for help from under bombed homes. Eventually, he and his family walked south across the strip past decomposing bodies. He was looking for water every day. In January, Ali was killed by an Israeli missile. And before he died, he told Muhammad that he changed his mind about killing Israelis. He said in order to deter Israel, he now supported armed attacks. So what does Israel think will happen given what we've seen over many decades to all of these young people who have lost everyone?
I mean, I think, unfortunately, the discourse in Israel and in much of the United States, too, is a discourse that portrays Palestinians, or at least most Palestinians, many Palestinians, as kind of barbarians who are inclined to behave this way because there's just something pathological about them. That was the same way that most people in the United States describe Native Americans. I mean, Native Americans, let's remember, in the 19th century were forced off of their land, concentrated in smaller and smaller reserves, and periodically, when they had the chance, sometimes broke out and committed terrible massacres of men, women, and children. And the discourse in the United States was not that this was a response to their dispossession. It was that these were barbarians, which therefore laid the foundation for even more brutal violence and the kind of rolling genocide in the United States in the 19th century. This is the way you talk about people when you dehumanize them. What I wish people would think about instead is cause and effect, is the way in which people respond to systems of violence with violence, and about the fundamental importance of giving people a nonviolent path towards gaining their freedom. One of the things that Muhammad and other Palestinians have told me who are from Gaza is about conversations they've had with people in Hamas, where people in Hamas say things like, "How well have your nonviolent efforts succeeded?" Remember, Palestinians in 2018 marched by the very, very large numbers of them, marched largely nonviolently to the separation barrier that divided them from Israel proper. How did Israel respond to that nonviolent march? Were the Palestinians congratulated for acting like Gandhis? No. Israel put snipers on the fence and shot people. Literally thousands of people were wounded. There were so many amputations that Gaza created an amputee soccer team after that. What does the United States do when Palestinians try boycotts? When they go to the United Nations, the International Criminal Court, we sanction the International Criminal Court. We criminalize those boycotts. We shut down the very avenues for nonviolent resistance that we claim that we want Palestinians to pursue. And then we're surprised that Palestinians used armed resistance. If you believe in nonviolence, and if you abhor attacks on Israeli civilians, as I do, you have to support giving people a nonviolent path towards struggling for freedom. You can't simply expect people to live year after year, generation after generation, without the basic human rights that we take for granted.
Before we get to emails, and we have a lot of emails, how do you explain why this has so much support inside of Israel? What are you hearing from people? I mean, to think that this could happen in such a small area that's not that far from Tel Aviv.
Well, when people become accustomed to systems of supremacy, they generally think that equality means death, means their death, their subjugation. This is not particular to Israelis. Think about the way that most white Southerners thought during the period of slavery or segregation. The assumption was that if Black people gained political equality, then the white people would be subjugated. The vast majority of white South Africans believed almost up until the day apartheid ended, that if it was a black government, their lives would be put in grave danger. I quote in my book the Northern Ireland Protestant leader Ian Paisley, who said on the eve of the Good Friday Accords, which gave Catholics political equality, he called it a prelude to genocide. So this is normal for people who are accustomed to supremacy. It's very difficult for them to imagine that they can thrive under conditions of equality. But I think that great moral movements can help people imagine the future differently and begin to see that equality under the law is actually the path to safety for both people who have been oppressed and people who have been beneficiaries of oppression, and that indeed, actually, the ending of oppression can be a kind of liberation, not only for the oppressed, but for the oppressors as well.
Today, we're joined by Peter Beinart. We're talking about his new book, Being Jewish After the Destruction of Gaza, A Reckoning. He writes, "My hope is that we will one day see Gaza's obliteration as a turning point in Jewish history." Peter is professor of journalism at CUNY, editor-at-large of Jewish Currents, and he writes the Beinart Notebook newsletter. We have a number of emails. Carol writes, "As an Arab American with full white privilege, I want to point out that Arab Americans as a whole in our country are misunderstood, ignored, and invisible, unless there's a possible terrorist event, even when the first place people look to for a culprit is to Arab and or Muslim communities. It is beyond tragic what's happening to Palestinians. I'm appalled at what Israel has done and continues to do. Their actions are alienating them from the world, while people who are not familiar with Jewish culture and values are developing a horrific and inaccurate understanding of who Israeli Jews are. I laud Peter Beinart for analyzing his family and cultural history, as well as reaching out and getting to know Palestinians and taking a stand that is not easy to do. I wish our politicians would learn from him." Thank you for your comment, Carol. What are your thoughts, especially about what she says about what Israel is doing and what this is doing to Jewish culture and values?
I worry about this a lot. It is essential that we make clear that Israel is a state, and that Jews and Judaism is something different, right? It is wrong to conflate the state of Israel with Jewish people, and it's wrong to hold Jews responsible for what Israel does, just like it's wrong to hold Chinese Americans responsible for what the People's Republic of China does. But the problem is that we have an Israeli government that speaks in the name of the Jewish people, and we also have Jewish organizations in the United States that insist that to support the state of Israel is inherent in being Jewish. That is very, very dangerous, this conflation. And it makes no sense. Judaism has existed for 2,000 years. It's an ancient and vast tradition. The state of Israel was only created in 1948. In fact, Jewish tradition, as I interpret it, is actually very skeptical of the whole notion of states. Jewish tradition does not think in terms of the right of states to exist. It thinks in terms of the right of human beings to exist. But this conflation, I do worry, is bad for Jews around the world. And I think that we as Jews have to begin to try to imagine Jewish life and Jewish tradition, which is not tainted by the moral corruption of a state that has committed apartheid and indeed even genocide.
Thank you for the email, Karen. Meg writes, "Shortly after the October 7th attack, I saw news reports saying that Israel had been warned about the pending attack well ahead of time. The warning came from young Israeli women stationed along the border with Gaza as part of their required military service. Have you heard about these reports? Do you know if there's been follow-up? Has anyone interviewed these women? What became of these warnings?" And for people who are not familiar with this, Peter, I mean, you could just search for it. Here's a BBC headline from January. They were Israel's eyes on the border, but their Hamas warnings went unheard. Here's a Politico headline. "Our warnings on Hamas were ignored, Israel's women border troops say."
Yes. I mean, I think that what happened was that Israel was arrogant. Israel thought that they had Hamas contained. They couldn't imagine that Hamas was capable of breaking out. They thought that all their high-tech surveillance would prevent this from happening. And also, Israel was really, because of the nature of this government, it was much more focused on the West Bank, on protecting settlers in the West Bank. And so it had fewer troops in what's called the Gaza envelope on the borders with Gaza. There hasn't been a full investigation because the Netanyahu government, unlike previous Israeli governments, has not allowed an independent investigation into what happened. But I think the reporting makes it clear that there were people who saw that Hamas was planning a major attack, but the Israeli government and the upper echelons of the military didn't take it seriously.
Haaretz has a piece just a few days ago called Netanyahu Coalition Blocks Knesset Proposal for October 7th State Probe Outraging Families. No one from the Prime Minister's office showed up as coalition lawmakers voted down the creation of a state commission to probe the 10-7 failures. Bereaved families accused Netanyahu's coalition of fighting the truth instead of seeking accountability. Do you think this will ever happen?
I don't know. I mean, partly it depends on Israel will have to go to elections presumably by next fall, within the next year, and it depends a lot on who wins those elections. Netanyahu is also been, indicted for corruption. Like Donald Trump and like other authoritarian leaders around the world, he's not a big fan of accountability and the rule of law. So he will try to avoid these things. The question there, I think, is whether politically he can be defeated so that a new, if he's defeated, the leaders who defeat him, I want to be clear, I don't think will pursue fundamentally different policies towards the Palestinians, tragically, but they might call for some greater degree of accountability for the, among the people in who were in power on October 7th.
Well, thank you for that, Meg. It's so easy to forget all of this news that has happened. If you search Women Warned Israel About October 7th, you'll find some soldiers talking with NBC, PBS, and CBS News. So they are speaking out, and it's really easy to find those videos. But thank you for bringing that to today's show. Nick writes, what is the moral justification for allowing American settlers from places like Brooklyn, New York, to move into and onto generational Palestinian property in the West Bank?
I don't think there is a justification. I believe that Israeli Jews have the right to live in the West Bank. This actually, the West Bank is from a biblical perspective, from Jewish tradition, actually probably more important than a lot of the land in Israel proper, which is closer to the coast. But the critical question is, are you living in the territory as an equal alongside your Palestinian neighbors under the same law, or are you living under a condition of legal supremacy where you have citizenship and due process and the right to free movement and the right to vote, and your Palestinian neighbors have none of those? That's a system that Israel's own human rights organizations have called apartheid. So the problem is not Jews living in the West Bank. The problem is Jews living in the West Bank with superior legal rights.
Alicia writes, I have many liberal Jewish friends with whom I discuss politics. Any suggestions on how to talk about Gaza without insulting or alienating them? And thank you for your work.
Well, I guess I think the thing that has the biggest impact, as I've said, is listening to Palestinians. When I, you know, in when I in Jew in the Jewish spaces that I inhabit, I would say the thing that I notice that changes people's views the most is some kind of sustained engagement with Palestinians. If it's reading a book by Palestinians or seeing films, there's so many films that have come out recently that are very, very powerful, or simply, or going to see for yourself if you go to Israel and then go to the West Bank and spend time with Palestinians. So I would really encourage people to do that. I think that if people care about this subject, they should want to try to explore it and understand it from all sides. And I think when one starts to be able to see Israel through Palestinian eyes, I think it almost inevitably changes the way people think.
And where do you see this going, Peter? I'm just reading more breaking news from the BBC. It says that with both Hamas and Israel accusing each other of breaking this U.S. brokered ceasefire, this is a test. U.S. pressure should make sure it holds. Fear in Gaza as Netanyahu orders new strikes. In our remaining 2 minutes, what do you think is next?
The macro question is whether Israel can do to Palestinians what the United States did to Native Americans and what was done to other Native populations in previous centuries. Gaza is less than 2% of the population between the river and the sea, between the Mediterranean and the Jordan. It holds 30% of the Palestinian population because Palestinians fled there when they were expelled in 1948. Now, after this Trump plan, basically half of Gaza is basically off limits to Palestinians. So what you see is the same thing we saw with Native Americans. People pushed into smaller and smaller enclaves. This story led to the destruction, the large-scale destruction of Native Americans in the United States and in other places in North America. The struggle that we have is to ensure that that process is stopped, that it cannot continue, and that indeed that we have a different future, a future that looks like equality and historical justice for Israelis and Palestinians. But that will take a fundamental change of U.S. policy.
Can you elaborate more on that? And we have about a minute or two left. U.S. policy under Biden and then under Trump. What are your thoughts?
Well, they're much more similar than they are different, really. I mean, the United States, we have a law on the books called the Leahy Law. The Leahy Law says the United States government is not allowed to sell weapons to the units of foreign militaries that have committed gross human rights abuses. That has never been applied to Israel. If it were applied to Israel, it would mean a radical shift in U.S. policy in which Israel, the United States would stop this unconditional flow of weapons, and Israel would have to think differently and behave differently because it simply could not carry out what it has been doing without this massive, massive flow of American weapons. And I think that's the critical question that that politicians must be forced to ask. How do you justify, especially given that we could be spending those tax dollars on things at home, dealing with the desperate needs of Americans at home, how do you justify spending millions and millions, giving basically Israel billions and billions of dollars to buy American weapons to implement practices that have been called apartheid and genocide by the world's leading human rights organizations? I think the more that question becomes front and center, I think the more we potentially see a shift, certainly in the Democratic Party, and maybe even eventually in the Republican Party.
Peter Beinart is author of the new book, Being Jewish After the Destruction of Gaza, A Reckoning. He's professor of journalism at CUNY, editor-at-large of Jewish Currents, and be sure to check out his newsletter, The Beinart Notebook. He interviews a number of a wide range of people, including Israeli historians and Palestinians. Peter, thank you so much for your work. Thank you for joining us. We have a number of people who are thanking you for your work, and we'd love to have you back.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.
Here's this news.